Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, Mormon Matters listeners, to another edition of our podcast. We're so excited to have you join us. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and we are going to bring a topic to your ears today that we've been planning for about a month now. It came up sort of naturally in the conversation that we had a few podcasts ago when we were discussing the recent survey about why people leave and things like this, and it just really hit us how important and how big an issue it is for many people whose spiritual worldview, their lives, their relationship with God begins to get a little more complicated, and it's that whole introduction of really the much more messy nature of human experiencing that we could become aware of, and it especially cuts close when it's the issue of we've been taught our whole lives that there's this thing called the Holy Ghost, there's this thing called the Spirit. We can tap into it and we can recognize when the Spirit is speaking to us and when it's not. And for many people, they're in turmoil over that. And all of us panelists are probably still all in turmoil over it ourselves. It's a difficult question, but we've got people with different wonderful backgrounds and different life stories and studies that they've done that relate to this. And I think you're going to be really, really thrilled with the conversation. Let me introduce our first panelist, and it's a veteran of our podcast of, I'm guessing, four or five. It's Christine Hagland. Would you mind reintroducing yourself to everybody?
Hi, I'm Christine Hagland. It's a lot easier to get to be an old timer around here than it is in Boston. I'm the editor of Dialogue, and I live in Boston with my three kids.
Any background?
My background is generally irrelevant. I have degrees in German studies and German literature, but I have been Mormon my whole life and grew up in a really nerdy Mormon family. So I had my first crisis over polygamy when I was 11 years old, and I've been reading Mormon history and Mormon studies stuff pretty much ever since then.
Good. Thank you. And I know you're a musician and have a very aesthetic sort of approach to a lot of spiritual things. And so I hope you'll use that to inform tonight too.
Okay.
So thank you very much. Scott Hawley is back with us for the second time. Scott was part of that conversation that we did on the survey. He was part of the team that helped put that together and did the analytics on it and things like that. Scott, would you remind everybody a little bit about your background?
Well, thanks, Dan. Glad to be on. My name is Scott Hawley. Until recently, lived near Christine in Boston. Earlier this year, relocated to Washington State with my wife and two children. Live in Mount Vernon, Washington, which, thanks to Dan Weatherspoon, has a large and vibrant Mormon community because he baptized them all when he was here on his mission.
7 months in Mount Vernon, Skagit Valley. Loved it.
So we're still planning our reunion, Dan.
Definitely. I'm coming up.
Excited to get you back here and see your legions.
For sure.
Very good.
Well, thanks. And tell us a little bit more about I know you have a business background and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So I work in finance. I have a background in finance and strategy consulting, an MBA from a school out in Boston. And that's about it. So I'll be bringing in a little bit of all of that stuff, including some management theory stuff towards the end.
Great. And do you want to share any bit about your biography? As I was talking with you and things like that, I kind of learned that this particular issue was one of the huge moments in your spiritual.
Sure. Yeah, I'll give a little bit of background there and then maybe a little bit more when I dive into some of the particulars. But my faith journey, I'm hesitant to use the term faith crisis because it does seem so loaded, but I guess my faith transition points have included a couple of major stops. The first was very historical related, and then the second was very closely related to this topic of distinguishing emotion versus spirit, and that just happened really within the past year. So spent a lot of time looking at these issues, and hopefully we'll be able to bring some of that to bear in the conversation.
Great. Thank you for being here, and thank you, Christine. I don't know if I said thanks. Michael Adam Ferguson, many of you on the blogs and the Facebook communities that center around these podcasts will know Michael. He's a wonderful participant in addition there. I finally met Michael, 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago?
Just about then, yeah.
We hit it off, and your background is in brain stuff and all that stuff. Would you introduce yourself and make sure to include what you do for a living and all that good stuff?
Sure. I'm from Virginia. I'm currently in Salt Lake City at the University of Utah, where I'm working on my PhD. My degree is in bioengineering, but I'm doing functional imaging of the brain, and I'm very interested in brain networks, distributed networks in the brain, the way that they are comprised and the way they interact with one another. Right now, I'm doing some studies into social neuroscience, a lot of studies related to autism, as well as related to the healthy development of the human brain.
Great, and I know that you're a big reader in just sort of spiritual experience, you know, in sort of just religion and wider spirituality and things like that. I know, for instance, you're reading a book by one of my former professors, Ann Taves, about re-examining what's going on in religious experience.
That's right. You know, if I can go ahead and jump in with a short story here, this fascination was really fueled for me in primary in the LDS Church, that we had a lesson on the resurrection, and the teacher had a glove that she put over her hand, and she said, "This is the body with the spirit in it," and she took the glove off of her hand and laid the glove on the table and said, "This is the body without the spirit in it," and then she moved her hand and said, "This is the spirit right here." And so at that very early age, you know, of course I didn't frame it this way, but she introduced the concept of Cartesian duality to me. And, you know, from that moment on, I really have been fascinated to understand how we can validate or how we can explore this particular assertion of duality and how it affects the way that we interact with our myths, in addition to the way that we conceive of ourselves and our identities as humans.
Awesome. Well, it is great to have you. And if you don't mind me helping tease a future project of yours that has to do with these communities that listen to this podcast and others, do you mind sharing a little bit about what's coming up? Please.
Not at all. I'm working to help develop a sister podcast to the Mormon Stories podcast, and it'll be a gay Mormon Stories podcast, specifically interviewing individuals who have been affected by the intersection of LGBT topics in addition to Mormonism.
Well, we're excited about that, and you're going to do wonderfully. I'm just so glad to have you on and had to have met you, and I know we're going to have great conversations as we go throughout our lives.
I'm excited.
Hey, everybody, let's get started. Did anybody have anything before we dive right in with Michael's section? We had planned to have Michael take us through a little bit of, four or five different framings that range from broad theoretical to a little bit more about the specifics of neurology and whatnot. But Christine or Scott, anything to jump in with first?
Nope.
Okay. Michael, take it away, and we'll just all pepper you with questions as you go along.
Perfect. Well, I wanted to jump in by framing this in terms of a debate that's been going on for quite a long time here. And I think that it was articulated very nicely by Rudolf Otto on one hand, he was a Lutheran theologian and a scholar, and William James on the other hand, who was an eminent psychologist and scholar in the late 19th, early 20th century. And the terms that we use are essentialism and constructionism. So both of these gentlemen, Otto and James, were very interested in the spiritual life and in understanding in a scholarly and a rigorous way the way that human beings interact with the spiritual and the mystical realm. On the one hand, you had Rudolf Otto, who asserted that the only way that we could truly encapsulate the mystical and the religious experiences of human beings was by designating them as their own class of unique experiences. And so this is generally termed essentialism, you know, related to the word essence, that there's something that is unique and essential to the religious experience in and of itself. And so Otto is famous for coining the term numinous to describe this sort of realm where it seems to be set apart from our daily interactions and operations. On the other hand, you have William James, who asserted that any experience that we have, including religious and spiritual experiences, are a composite of more elemental components of our psychology and of our emotion. And so the general term for that framing is constructionalism, that these experiences that we have that are mystical or spiritual in nature, or that we deem as mystical or spiritual in nature, are constructed for more elemental psychological and emotional phenomena. And so this tension between essentialism versus constructionalism is one that I think is really productive as we delve into these issues.
Well, cool. I love those categories, and I definitely, it's great to have them out there. But Michael, you can't introduce these without at least giving us which way you lean. The term sui generis, you know, a thing in and of itself, of its own kind, which is another way we could sort of claim with the Otto's position. What do you sense about, is there something distinct?
Sure. So my bias is definitely toward essentialism, but I put a little bit of an asterisk after that. And here's why. It's because most people assume that if you start talking about essentialism, that you're immediately jumping to conclusions of dualism. And so if I can take a moment to elucidate this framing as well, that you have dualism, which is the idea that there is some type of metaphysical substance, some type of spirit that has its own life independent of the body. And on the other hand, monism is the idea that everything that we experience, all of our internal states, all of our subjective phenomena, are completely products of our biological and our physical nature. And so
That's kind of narrow. I mean, it just means monism just simply... one, you know, it's just emphasizing that, but I wouldn't say that you have to necessarily say that they're all products of each other. You just need to say that there's no separate spiritual realm.
Okay, fair enough.
But because Mormonism, of course, would not be a dualist tradition, even though we talk about spirit and body and stuff, right?
I would argue that it is. That might be a productive conversation for us to tease out here. I would say, though, that going back to the essentialism versus constructionalism conversation, that the history of human evolution itself is so compellingly slanted toward the integration of religious experience. You look at tribal cultures, you look throughout anthropological history, and the relationship of human beings with a perceived spirit realm is so ubiquitous, and it's so pervasive that there's a strong argument to be made that in it itself has influenced the trajectory of human evolution. I'll reference really quickly here an evolutionary psychologist named Jesse Baring, who's done some interesting experiments called the Princess Alice experiments, where, in short, one of the experimental conditions was to have young children come into a room and to participate in a simple guessing game wherein they had the opportunity to cheat. Part of the group was told that there was an invisible magical princess named Princess Alice who was in the room who was going to be observing them. And, you know, somewhat predictably, the group of children who were told that Princess Alice was in the room had a significantly reduced incidence of cheating in the game. And so Baring goes on to make some compelling arguments for the valuable role that belief in a supernatural has had in shaping our evolution into the hypersocial beings that we are. And so from that perspective, from the evolutionary psychological perspective, I think that there is compelling data to suggest that our brains have evolved to interact with God and with the idea of God and of the supernatural in a way that, you know, I would not be surprised at all if in the future we're looking at systems of the brain that are evolved and dedicated toward these types of operations and these types of cognitive processes. So from that sense, I would consider myself leaning toward essentialism, but that asterisk being that a lot of it, I think, can still be grounded in naturalism.
Hey, Michael, just a quick question on that study that you referred to. You mentioned that it was with children, and you know, I have a son who's 3, and he's just now getting to the point where he's, you know, putting his dolls all in a pile and saying that it's a fireplace, you know, that he's beginning to imagine himself within the world. But obviously when he's older, that, you know, he won't be doing the same thing. Is what would you say to the argument that, well, that experiment just was a representation of human development, and that, you know, when I was a child, I thought like a child and act like a child, but when I was an adult, I put off childish things.
Not okay. You might have to help me tease out the question there.
I guess you mentioned that the experiment with the child was an indication that as humans we're kind of primed for this experience of thinking about God. And I was just wondering if you thought that maybe his experiment would have yielded similar results if it was tried on adults. It doesn't seem like it would work the same way.
Agreed. However, I mean, just given the overwhelming majority of adults on the earth right now who claim to have some type of engagement with the supernatural or some type of awareness or belief in the supernatural, and yet each of these claims are, you know, radically contradictory to one another and incompatible in many ways with one another, that it seems like that kernel of priming that, again, from these experiments, looks like it's rooted in some type of biology that is more transcendent than just the cultural priming that would have led to the beliefs. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, that's great.
Here's my dilemma. Michael, we could go really wonky here and we could have a great discussion about Mormon theology,
yeah,
and whether, you know, the continuum that Joseph Smith seems to lay out of spirit is still material, it's just more refined. And of course, everyone knows that I'm sort of into process theology, which doesn't talk about any kind of dualism either. It's more like there's a differences in kind or differences in degree between things, not differences in kind, you know, basically it's all the same experiencing stuff. So dualism for me doesn't work. I mean, it's not my initial, you know, but I don't lean there unless, you know, I were forced to almost by more compelling reasons otherwise. But how I at least interact with the idea of the ubiquitous nature of spiritual experiences and stuff like this, and this is maybe where we can bring Christine in and stuff like that. I tend to believe that whatever this continuum is that we're all part of, there is a type of energy that comes when we're using our intellect. There's a type of energy that comes in an aesthetic experience. There's a type of energy that comes, you know, just as you sort of tune into different, you know, wavelengths of all these different things. And I don't necessarily see that it's a supernatural thing. It's not the everyday often, because I think our, you know, minds and whatnot, and here's where you can take us into brain stuff. You know, we're selecting a very narrow range of all the information that's flying at us, right? And consciousness is such a powerful thing, and all the things that are, you know, in our DNA that have helped us, we need to survive, we need to pay attention, you know, fight or flight, have to be always ready. All those different things are helping us stay away from the more subtle things, but yet there are those moments in our lives when we're exposed to, you know, music or somehow or other, we just feel a different energy when we're in sort of a different, you know, angle on the world and experience in the world. Those to me are plenty to explain the ubiquitous nature of it without there being a separate realm that, you know, God or the spirit is. So does that make any sense? That's why I would probably, you and I, we ought to have you on if we do ever do a philosophy debate about dualism or monism.
Yeah, that would be interesting, because it does in a way start to become a semantic issue, you know, as far as like where you're drawing the line as classification into dualism. Because I would dare say that there are people who would characterize the perspective that you're painting here as a dualist perspective. But yeah, that would be a great conversation to explore sometime.
Christine, it sounded like you had something to say there.
I was trying to clarify what you were saying, which I think was that there's a transcendent realm that is not necessarily outside of human consciousness. It's just a different sort of corner of it.
Yeah, I guess so. You're waking every day, you know, highly sensorial world that, you know, characterizes most of our waking life. We know that when we're in sleep, you know, we move into a theta, you know, type brain wave, and, you know, versus our normal beta, and all those different things. So I just, to me, it's not a separate type of realm. It's just, you know, there's everyone wants to say supernatural. No, it's all natural. it's just, right. You know, you sort of align yourself, or you feel yourself at a kind of operating at a different level sometimes, and so you're accessing different parts of this unified reality. So that's just for me. I just don't tend to want to divide it up, even though there's a wide continuum. But Michael, you might say at a certain point, you know, the degree is so different that you might as well talk about it as difference in kind.
Sure.
I hope we haven't put our podcast listeners to sleep with this, because maybe we just got a little bit wonky there. But and maybe we can discuss us as panelists afterwards whether to keep that little section. But I had fun, so hopefully you're all with us. But Michael, thank you for that. You know, it's good to have essentialism, constructivism, and all that stuff in the background. Take us where you want to go next.
Sure. So the next place that I want to go is again on the history of the evolution of the human brain. And there is an interesting observation made by an anthropologist whose last name is Dunbar. And Dunbar realized that if you look at primate brains, that the volumes of the cerebral cortex in their brains are directly proportional to the size of their social groups. And so there's a lot of work that's been done around this to assert that the driving force of evolution in the human brain was a social force, that we were primed to be extremely social organisms, that the survivability of the group ended up becoming a major driving factor. And so this feeds into maybe some of the studies that we'll talk about a little bit later on, where it turns out that a lot of the regions of the brain that go online when individuals are activating thoughts about God and processing their experience with God or with the numinous are indeed these social regions of the brain. And so, I mean, this to me just opens up a whole range of questions as far as the way that that processing happens at the level of the brain, that there is a certain type of efficiency that the brain tries to optimize, that the brain is an energy-consuming machine, and it wants to maximize its operations with the least amount of energy that's necessary. That's just one of kind of the physical constraints that we're dealing with when we're looking at neuroscience here. And so if there's this highly developed system to accommodate social processing in the human being, then of course, if we're starting to talk about really lofty concepts like the totality of the universe or a realm beyond our sensory experiences, that it would make sense from this naturalistic perspective that this highly sophisticated social processing unit would come into play, and that we'd start sort of flipping into that realm of ways of engaging the different inputs that we have for some of these really esoteric concepts that we see reflected in religion. And so, in other words, because our brains have been driven to evolve by our social context, it makes a lot of sense that so many of the ways that human societies have interacted with the bigger questions or with the more mystical transcendent questions have been with, you know, anthropomorphizing the universe, or, you know, having some kind of system wherein we have these deities who themselves have personalities and with whom we can have social relationships, and they're the ones who are pulling the strings behind the scenes. So that's another piece that I would introduce into the conversation here, this concept that intrinsically we are social beings, and that the social selective pressures were so key in accelerating our evolution toward our current state as human beings. And so it would just make sense that so many of the ways that we process the big questions and the really complex questions about the universe would be usurped by the ways that we process our social cognition.
Yeah, very, very interesting. You're not using this as an argument that therefore there are these beings that we truly are socializing with, are you?
Oh, no, I'm not. And I mean, if anything, the majority of the arguments, perhaps to the chagrin of many of the listeners, are neutral as far as, you know, hard conclusions one way or another, you know, to the literality or to the deniability of spirit realms or of something beyond the physical realm that we engage with our senses.
Good. Sounds like, Michael, you're just sort of introducing vocabulary and just concepts that might be helpful for us later.
I am, yeah. And so this is where the stories start to fuse together. That on the one hand, we have this incredible biological computational processing unit inside of our heads that, again, was driven to its current state mostly by the selective pressures from our social contexts. On the other hand, you know, we've got this clear evidence of ancient beliefs in mystical and spiritual beings that have definitely interacted with the development of societies in terms of enforcement of fairness, in terms of cohesion. When you have a tribe that is worshiping the same deity, that there's this unity in the social group. And so I think that there's a parallel here with the sensory aspect of spiritual experiences and the attributional aspect of religious experiences. Or in other words, that we can have different sensations, we can have different emotions and different feelings. And, you know, again, we can return to the question of essentialism versus constructionalism, whether there's any emotion that is distinctly a spiritual emotion. But the second part of that is that anytime that we have an emotion or a sensory experience, we interpret it, we assign meaning to it, we integrate it into our narrative. One of the emotions that I would like to talk about here is one that, you know, has been identified by a researcher named Jonathan Haidt, who he's a psychologist at the University of Virginia. And I'm just going to read directly off of the University of Virginia website here. And it's talking about an emotion that he's identified as elevation. And it says, a warm or glowing feeling in the chest, tears welling up, perhaps even chills, and a clenching of the throat, a desire to connect with the person you've been watching, a new inclination to participate in charitable activities. And that's a description that, I mean, when I read it, I thought, oh my gosh, that's almost out of a Sunday school manual, you know, for how to recognize the Spirit.
Sounds like Galatians.
Galatians 5.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so here you have, and you know, a psychologist who's saying that there's this emotion of elevation that, again, it's biological in nature, that Jonathan Haidt goes through and he explains a framework for the evolutionary advantage of elevation as an emotion, you know, to have a positive reward response when you see people participating in altruistic and charitable ways within your tribe or within your community, a feeling of affinity and admiration toward them, a desire to emulate them. That, you know, it's not too hard to imagine how all of these experiences would be very advantageous in terms of increasing the cooperativity of a group. So sliding over onto the other aspect of religious experiences, which is the attributional aspect, that anytime that we have a sensory or an emotional event, that we process it and we assign meaning to it. And so in this way, it becomes kind of tricky to dice out, okay, how am I going to say that these experiences that I've been taught are unique to the Spirit, are unique to God, are unique to grace and divinity, are now being investigated in a biological or in a psychological framework? I think that we've got this cognitive aspect for assigning religious meaning to events, and we've got this sensory emotional component of the religious experiences themselves. And what seems to have been the norm in science over the past decades is to sort of deny these religious experiences. Do any of you guys have any commentary about that idea of elevation?
I was going to say, I mean, it sounds a little bit like, I mean, we have this inchoate experience, right? We have these sensations and impulses that we don't have language for, right? I mean, that right. Those don't come with words attached necessarily. And it seems to me that, you know, religion has provided the vocabulary for talking about them. And psychology can provide a different vocabulary for talking about them. Mm-hmm. I mean, this isn't the whole crux of it, but there's certainly an element of it that seems to me merely a problem of linguistics, of sort of mapping words onto experiences that are not by nature verbal.
Yeah, and I was actually going to add a comment, maybe a question, which is, how does this feeling of elevation translate into what we would consider a revelatory experience or a feeling of knowing? Are they linked? Is it the same cause? Does the feeling of knowing that often accompanies the feeling of transcendence that you're talking about, Michael, are those coming from the same source in this model, or are they different?
So that's a great question. And I think that ties in these two different elements here, as far as the sensory experience and the attributional element. Because, you know, speaking in first person, in my upbringing in the LDS church, that I had this array of theological truth claims that were given to me. And the validation for them was this emotional experience that sounds very much like what's being described as elevation. And I mean, as many of the listeners here are going to be familiar with, you look across a number of different theological systems, and consistently one of the ways that the truth is established to the believer is through the emotive or the sensory experience that they have within the context of the theology. And so as we start to parse these out, I think that's a great observation that Christine makes about this being a linguistic problem, and that because we've had these religious structures that have primarily been assigning languages and symbols and myths to explain or to refer to these, you know, more elevating emotional experiences, that those have been the primary vocabulary with which we've explored and expressed these particular experiences. And so, you know, as we start to roll that back, it does become an interesting question about, okay, how do you, without that particular emotional piece being unique to the religious domain, then how do you go about parsing out some of these more finer, you know, cognitive and theological claims?
Yep.
Can I toss an anecdote in and a question? Once upon a time, I taught a bunch of beehives, and I love that age, 12 and 13 year olds, especially these girls, because they were, you know, they're so smart, but they're not jaded yet at all, and they still have access to some of their sort of childlike wonder and freshness and all of those things, but they have a, you know, sophisticated enough vocabulary to describe it. And I was regularly just blown away by the ways that they would describe the beginnings of their own sense of their spirituality. You know, they used vivid metaphors. They came up with new ways of describing them. They had real and intense questions. You know, it was really wonderful to talk with them about what they were experiencing. And I felt like my own prayers and my own devotional life was enriched by the ways that they talked about their own experience. Then we moved away, and several of the girls from my beehive class went to BYU. And I happened to be visiting in that ward the week that they were home for Christmas, and the bishop asked them to speak. And they all got up and gave these, you know, perfectly scripted testimonies. They sounded very much alike and very much like I would imagine, you know, any freshman at BYU would speak. And I was sad, you know, for lots of reasons, but one of the things that I wondered was, when you lose the vocabulary, when you stop trying to come up with vivid descriptions and you accept sort of, you know, hackneyed phrases and cliches that we toss around, when you adopt that vocabulary of the adults around you, do you eventually actually lose the capacity for those vivid experiences? Are you narrowing the range of your spiritual capability because you've narrowed the idioms with which you describe it?
Mm. I think that makes a ton of sense. And I'm actually reminded of a book written by a folklorist named Tom Mould called Still the Small Voice, where he actually goes in. I don't know if you had a chance to – have any of you had a chance to read that?
Yeah.
He basically is – he's a non-Mormon, but he sits in fast and testimony meetings and missionary experiences and family home evenings, and he catalogs nearly 500 personal revelation experiences. And he talks about how – the evaluation of the experience on the part of the hearer has a really strong effect on how it's delivered by the speaker, which, you know, it's not too much of a stretch to think actually has an impact on how it's experienced by the believer. And so you have, you know, people, the more dramatic experiences obviously are judged with a lot more scrutiny. And you have to show, you know, the influence of God, but at the same time, humility. So you have to balance that, you know, am I being demonstrating pridefulness if I'm talking about this great experience? And since we are, you know, in a faith where there is such a strong ritual around the sharing of the testimony, that can have a real impact on what type of experiences they're actually experiencing and how they're interpreting them.
Awesome. That is so important. I'm glad you put that in there, Christine. Thank you. Thank you, Scott, too. Hey, I have one question back to hate and elevation too, Michael. Christine kind of got us in that, you know, is it just a matter of labeling? And we've had that nice discussion of, yeah, these have been the labels because theology and religion had the vocabulary at first, and now we're starting to add the different ones and all that stuff. But I just want to get back to hate's question. It seemed like you were talking in terms of it's advantageous in an evolutionary sense that these sorts of things would happen. And so was he trying to say that there is a sufficient explanation, he believes, for elevation purely in the competitive advantage type of evolution?
My understanding is that is a framework that Haight works in. And I mean, he talks specifically about how a lot of the master spiritual teachers like Jesus or Buddha, you know, inspired people to abandon everyday lives and to follow them. And that a lot of it is because, you know, according to Haight, that these teachers tapped into these, you know, really powerful experiences that have been built into the biological social system and that are triggered by these elevating stories and these elevating narratives. I've talked quite a bit about philosophy and psychology to frame it. If it's okay, I'd like to dive a little bit down the rabbit hole with biology and see where that takes
sure.
us. Is that
sure.
okay?
Great.
So as far as religious experiences go, I think that three really interesting touchstones are, first, a syndrome called Gschwind syndrome. It's a temporal lobe epilepsy, and there's this cluster of symptoms that are associated with it. For example, hypergraphia, like the strong impulse to just write a lot. Circumstantial speech. Yeah, exactly.
Hey! We've explained it!
Diagnosis.
Yeah. Circumstantial speech, where you get to your point, but you take all of these detours and you kind of wander into these tangential thoughts before you get to your main point. Intensified cognitive and emotional life, decreased sexual interest, also hypermoral and hyper-religious thought processing, where the concept of morality and religiosity just becomes overly important to the person who's experiencing the syndrome. And it's a very clear-cut case wherein some type of abnormality in the brain ends up producing this cluster of symptoms that are, you know, in many ways associated with a devotional type of life.
Okay. are you going to like introduce three things and then we'll talk about them, or do we?
We can talk about that one. We can talk about Gschwind syndrome here.
So is the person who's describing this and is making this connection with religious experience, again, are they saying that explains everybody who has those symptoms? In other words, he really thinks if he put you in a brain scanner, he would find temporal lobe action going on here that's abnormal?
I don't think so. The physician who coined the term, his name was Norman Gschwind, and he characterized these clusters of symptoms in patients that had temporal lobe epilepsy. And I wouldn't go so far to say that, you know, any such symptom could be explained by a similar type of neurological factor, but just to say that, you know, there's very clear evidence that the biology certainly has impact on the intensity with which a person considers morality, or the intensity with which they feel devoted or connected to religiosity and religious considerations, that a lot of these symptoms are influenced clearly by biological factors.
Okay, so you would say neither Gschwind, or however you say his name, or other people that have studied this are making the strong claim, because I hear this all the time from those, especially yeah. early in a crisis or early in a reframing. Well, if you've had those things, you probably have this epilepsy. I mean, it's one of the, you know, it's one of the easy things. Would anybody who's really looked at this make those kind of clear claims that I'm hearing? You know, to me, it's lazy argumentation.
I don't think so at all. I mean, that would definitely be overly simplistic. You would definitely have people who would extrapolate and who would say that we see clear biological influences on personality traits and characteristics that are associated with religiosity. Therefore, we can chalk the entire domain up to biology. But as far as to specifically say, you know, temporal lobe epilepsy itself, that would be, okay. I think that even, you know, your most hardcore materialistic neuroscientist who is good at what they were doing would blush to attribute all type of religious phenomenology to, you know, just a little simple.
Yeah, and maybe I'm actually being unfair, because what you said right before that last little bit was probably more what they're saying, and they're just throwing the epilepsy as one of the elements. But they are basically saying that everything is upward causation rather than there is no downward causation. And those are the terms that are, maybe it's new terms, so we'll just quickly. Upward causation means all higher things are caused by something, you know, biological. It comes from the bottom up, or it comes from the body out. Where downward causation is the idea that something outside of you affects your physical and mental state. And so right. A lot of people just believe, and they make these claims, and to me, they're quite quickly made, that everything is upward causation only. And to me, a few questions get you to where they're already talking about downward causation too. So anyway, I just know where I come down on all this. I don't think it all can be explained that way. So
sure. Well, and this is a good segue into the second talking point that I wanted to bring up, which is the so-called God helmet. And so two scientists, Stanley Coren and Michael Persinger, created this helmet that supposedly it stimulates the temporal lobes by, you know, very faint magnetic pulses. And they put this helmet on people that was equipped with these magnetic stimuli, and individuals claimed to be having the perception that there was another being behind them or in the room, or some people claim to have out-of-body experiences or other types of mystical experiences. And so that sort of contributed to the conversation piece that these are, you know, bottom-up causation, that it's the biology that's creating the epiphenomenon. Interesting, though, that the story gets a little bit thicker with the God helmet. In 2004, the magazine Nature reported that a group in Sweden tried to replicate the God helmet experiments and was unable to do so. And then there were another series of papers of people who were saying that they were trying to repeat the originally reported results of the God helmet and were unable to do so. And it really cast a big question mark around the original claims of the God helmet. And so far, it seems that the most powerful predictor for whether or not people will have some type of religious or mystical experience when they're wearing a so-called God helmet is the degree of suggestibility of the individual. Mm-hmm. And so that's really interesting. And that feeds back into this second piece of attribution. You know, before I was talking about that you've got just the raw sensory component, but then also the attributional component. And they're really distinct systems. And I think that perhaps ironically, that the God helmet ended up accentuating not the sensory component of a religious experience, but actually the attributional component, where again, the greatest predictive factor to whether or not somebody reported a religious experience after wearing the God helmet was the level of suggestibility of the person.
So it's not, Michael, that the people who put on the helmet were not experiencing anything. It's just that the way they described the experience perhaps depended on the background that they had been socialized into.
No, it was the report of an experience, period.
Okay.
Yeah, that there was question about whether or not the helmet was actually inducing a sensory experience.
Anything.
At all. Yeah.
So that's actually really interesting if it really is the suggestibility power, because many of the people who have actually put on the God helmet and explained it have been skeptics in and of themselves.
As far as, are you referring to, I know that, for example, Richard Dawkins
put on the God helmet
and said that, yeah, that he didn't have any sensed experience or anything like that.
Okay. Yeah, I might be wrong with that.
Yeah, well, that is really interesting stuff. But again, my understanding is the Persinger helmet and all that. So weren't they able to, like, supposedly induce paranoia, fear, you know, all sorts of things? We weren't just searching for religious experience, right?
Right, and that's and so it does get a little bit complicated, because there was a subset of people who claimed to be having some type of experience, like they felt that there was a presence or, you know, some type of unusual phenomenon, but they didn't necessarily attribute it to a divinity or to a spirit or something like that.
Yeah. Anyway, to me, the whole thing gets complicated even without the questions about being able to duplicate the experiments and, you know, this piece about suggestibility and all that. Again, it boggles me to say that it's all upward causation simply because if there are certain things happening in my brain when I'm fearful, if there are certain things happening in my brain when I'm asleep, when I'm certain things, you know, that I'm experiencing or prone to experience when I'm, you know, I've achieved a meditative state where maybe I'm entering into a delta or, you know, some sort of relaxed but alert alpha kind of brain state or something. I've done that externally, and now it's feeding back into what you'll be able to look at in my brain. So just this whole idea that, oh, you're having an experience, it's all biological. No, we did our actions, many of us, you know, to get ourselves into a relaxed state and to quiet our brain chatter to where we might be able to, you know, access this different, to me again, part of the larger continuum of energies and whatnot that we're all in the midst of. So of course this stuff's going to map in our brain somewhere. Our brains are part of this, yeah, this whole thing. And so it boggles my mind that, again, it feels like such easily dismissible argumentation for people to purely claim upward causation.
Sure. Yeah, well, and especially when, I mean, sort of the basis for the dismissal is, well, we know that these things don't occur, or we know these things don't exist, therefore there's no way that they could be causing the phenomena that we're observing in the brain, you know? That it's this a priori assumption of their non-existence.
Right. Or, you know, and it really is an important question, and you kind of hit at it earlier, Christine named it, are we just afraid of using the language of spirit? You know, once we begin to complicate, oh, this, you know, we used to know it was the Holy Ghost, now we don't know it's the Holy Ghost, and so a lot of us, we just run away from anything that would suggest the earlier naive belief that we had, you know? Does that make any sense? To me, I really just, you know, like, some people, sure, don't want to use God language at all, and yet God language can be very, very helpful because they're afraid that if I say the word God, you're going to automatically assume that I mean white bearded guy, you know?
Right. So. Well, and I think also, and this is a little bit of a tangent, but I think that a lot of it comes down to power structures as well. It's an interesting phenomenon to look at the general receptivity in the United States for Eastern spiritualities versus Western religious traditions.
Yes.
That there's I think that there's just this human hunger that we have for some type of, you know, for lack of a better term, of spirituality. You know, that you've got yoga studios popping up all over the place, meditation studios popping up all over the urban metropolitan centers in the United States, that people who have been burned by Western religion, a lot of them still feel some desire to connect on this spiritual dimension. And in the United States, I mean, we have political candidates who are grabbing for power that's related to the buy-in of Western mythical structures. But on the other hand, the Eastern mythical structures in a Western context aren't associated with that same, you know, power question. And similarly, if someone came up in a Mormon background, it has so much more baggage for them to use that language from the Mormon lexicon versus, you know, a spiritual or a mythical language that's not related to the power systems that they were trying to evade in their developmental stages.
I guess I have a question with that, though, which is, you know, that approach or that concern makes sense if you are approaching it from from a religious perspective, but if I am coming at this strictly from the scientific perspective, and perhaps I'm not saying there is no God in this at all, but I'm asking the believer, give me a justification for why God should be inserted into this model, or more to the point, how we can have a certainty that the model is incomplete without God. What would the response be that's, you know, that could be faithful to both camps?
Sure, my answer is that a big piece of it would be, you know, a rigorous study of religious phenomenology, of the internal states that are achieved primarily, you know, right now primarily through spiritual religious practices. The fact that they occur, to me, is, I mean, inherently evidentiary that there's biology that supports these experiences, and that there's something about religion, there's something about the myths that are directing us to these aspects of our nature, these aspects of our cognition and of our processing that are related to these internal states that right now we're primarily being directed toward through religious vehicles. That, you know, if they're, you know, give it another 50 years of study with positive psychology and positive neuroscience, where we're mapping out these experiences of enlightenment, these experiences of augmented sense of morality and of unification with all of life that people experience in deep meditative or trance-like states, and we're, you know, able to produce similar outcomes without indulging the mythical systems and the traditional systems, then I think that it becomes a more poignant question about what we gain by bringing God into the equation. But right now, both my observation as well as just my personal subjective experience is that the myths and the God language bring in a way of connecting to internal states and internal experiences that I just don't see elucidated and really explored thoroughly through the scientific lens.
I guess the question I would have, though, is the lens that you're viewing that through is a cognitive lens that's subject to all of the biases that, you know, we've talked and that we will talk about. So I guess the question I have is how certainty can be justified in this. And I'm not saying that's where you're headed, but even it seems that you would almost have to solve that equation that you're talking about in the future by having something unexplained. So we've mapped out all of these experiences and we have a near flawless understanding of the systems of the brain and have decided that there's nothing here that can explain that. Is that kind of what you're talking about, or have I misunderstood?
Not necessarily. I'm just saying that right now, with our current level of understanding, that there's this rich repertoire of human experiences that are, you know, very well documented, that seem to have parallels across different cultures, that indicate that, okay, we've got biological features, we have potential, you know, wired into our brain that we don't access through the scientific process itself as it is right now. It's not, you know, I'm not saying that as a validation for like the ultimate inclusion of God into the system or into the language or into the model of how we explain life in the universe.
Yeah.
Got it.
So the third little case study here, as far as biological basis for spiritual experiences, is the Marsh Chapel experiment that was conducted in 1962 at the Harvard Divinity School under Timothy Leary, where they had half of the divinity students who partook of, you know, a psilocybin mixture, which, you know, is referred to as magic mushrooms, more in layman's terms, and then just a niacin solution that caused face flush, so they felt like they were having some type of experience, but it didn't have the same psychedelic properties as the psilocybin itself. And there was actually a follow-up study that was conducted in 2006 at Johns Hopkins, where, again, they had half of the participants take a solution of psilocybin, and 14 months later, they surveyed them to explore the meaningfulness and also the longevity of the sense of meaning that they had in the experiment itself. And 64% said that 14 months later that they had an increased sense of well-being and of life satisfaction. And 67% said that the experience of the psilocybin was one of the five most spiritually significant experiences of their entire life. And 58% said that it was one of their five most meaningful life experiences, period, without the constraint of, you know, most significant spiritual experience. And so, again, it's another really interesting case study where we can see very clearly a chemical and a biological basis for an experience that individuals attribute to, you know, being spiritually meaningful. As far as actual mechanics of psilocybin on the brain, there's a paper that was actually just published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that demonstrated that psilocybin interrupts what's called the default mode network of the brain. That this is one of the major directions in neuroscience, is to get away from just looking at individual spots in the brain. I think that this idea was popular for a while, that, oh, we have a God spot or a love spot, but that, you know, really we need to look at the brain more holistically and in terms of networks. And, you know, the default mode network is a very mysterious network. It's a very unknown network at this point as far as its clear functions. But certainly the assignment of meaning, the process of personal narrative, are functions that are strongly implicated with the default network. And so it's very interesting, again, that the psilocybin experiment specifically disrupted the correlations of major hubs within this default network, within this network that is involved with personal narrative or with the assignment of meaning.
Interesting.
So, Michael, when I hear the and by the way, I'm loving the magic shrooms, and I'm wondering if there's a drugstore that we can go and replicate this with afterwards. My guess is probably not.
We should have done it before.
Yeah, there we go.
Actually, everyone has taken the niacin magic shrooms concoction before this.
Yeah,
we're still this.
We're still working through it. But I guess the question I have is, I listen to that and it's screaming to me constructionalism, and you're talking about it as you know, something to support essentialism, or maybe you're not. Maybe I'm putting your words in your mouth. But do you see that as being more supportive of one or the other?
I was mostly just bringing it up as a reference point for a clear biological basis for experiences that we deem religious or spiritual nature. Yeah.
But is that a biological or chemical? I mean, because I think, you know, if the difference between the experience of God between those people and everyone else were the chemical interactions with our body and our minds, that would suggest that what's happening is occurring on the inside, projecting outwards. Does that make sense?
Sure. As opposed to leaving the door open for some type of downward causation where you have some external agent that's creating the experience.
Or that's flowing into you. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I guess would the argument have to be that that you're basically unlocking a biological pathway for an external force to enter? Is that how essentialism would play in there?
No, so essentialism, again, okay, these are good questions here. Let me think of how to tackle this. I feel like there's two different questions that we need to disentangle. One is the question of causation, that, you know, you're asking whether or not this implies that the causation, again, is upward causation, that it's bottom up, as opposed to having some type of external force or external agent that flows in to create the experience. That, I think that's different than the essentialism question, though, because, like I was saying before, that I don't think that that essentialism necessarily translates into dualism, or that essentialism necessarily contradicts naturalism or naturalistic explanations for these types of experiences that would be unique to religion or to religiosity.
Okay, so essentialism doesn't require that there's an external force, just that there's an internal component of spirit.
No. Okay, I've really done a bad job at explaining where I'm coming from with essentialism here. That when I'm talking about the concept of essentialism, that I think that we can still look at a naturalistic framework and say that, okay, there's something about religious experience, there's something about belief in the supernatural, there's something about believing in divinity and in deities that elicits unique responses or unique networks within our brain, or that concerts different networks in a way that is unique to religious belief and religious engagement. But that's not necessarily saying that therefore spirit and God are legitimized and validated as actually existing objectively.
Got okay. It. That's helpful. Thank you.
That's great. Thanks.
Dan, can I throw in one more piece here?
Sure.
So this is an analogy that might help clarify where I'm coming from on this, as far as really wanting to understand the biology that are involved in the concerted experiences of spiritual and religious phenomena. that think of a piano, think of studying the brain as basically looking inside of the piano to detail which strings are being played in a particular song, that just a study of the strings itself doesn't tell us whether or not this is a player piano that's automated or whether there's someone who's banging on the keys as an external agent, that, you know, that there, you know, there really is this limited scope to what we're dealing with when we're looking at the neurobiology of spiritual and religious experiences. And it's a very important set of questions, but some people might find it unsatisfying because, again, just looking at the strings inside of a piano doesn't give us the leverage to say who's playing the piano itself.
Excellent.
Great.
Yeah, that's a terrific analogy. You know, Christine, exactly what Michael just said, this player piano thing, there was something that you kind of pre-circulated to us a little bit about a guy named Owen Flanagan that at least sort of talks about the limits of science. Maybe, do you mind sharing some of that right now?
Yeah, we've talked about most of his argument just in different terms in the vocabularies of different disciplines, but he talks about this belief that that brain science could explain everything about religious experience. He calls that scientism. And he says the harmonization of this idea of the self or the soul with the scientific image of persons can be done only if believers of the manifest image, that's the soul, are willing to adjust in certain areas to yield their conceptions of mind, free will, and the self and replace them with ones that fit with the picture advanced by our best science. But there's no need for the manifest image to yield to the scientistic variant of the scientific image. Scientism is the brash and overreaching doctrine that says everything worth saying or expressing can be said or expressed in a scientific idiom. And then the sort of the most obvious and intuitive way that he counters that is, here's his next paragraph, the claim that science can explain everything we think, say, and do, that it can, in principle, provide a causal account of a human being, needs to be distinguished from the claim that everything can be expressed scientifically. Consider art and music. It's patently crazy to say that the work of Michelangelo, Da Vinci, Van Gogh, Cezanne, or Picasso, or of Mozart, Chopin, or Schoenberg, or of Duke Ellington, John Coltrane, Bob Dylan, or Nirvana could be expressed scientifically. Assuming something like the best case scenario for science, we might want to say that artistic and musical productions can be analyzed in terms of their physical manifestations, painting in terms of chemistry, and music in terms of mathematical relationships. Furthermore, some very complex combination of the culture, individual life, and the brain of some artist might allow for something like an explanatory sketch of why he produced the works he did. There's nothing odd about these kinds of scientific investigation of art or music or of the creative process itself. But although such inquiry takes artistic or musical production as something to be explained, it does not take the production itself as expressing something that can be stated scientifically.
Awesome.
So, yeah, it's the piano strings. That's actually a really good way to describe it, Michael.
Yeah.
I love that, Christine. If I could be just maybe for a moment disagreeable towards that, or maybe challenge a portion of that, I think that in my mind at least creates a little bit of a straw man in that I do not hear any scientist, and particularly brain scientists, saying that we have that science has unlocked everything. Just that the scientific method is probably a better method that we have available at our disposal to make incremental improvements in our knowledge, and that until a better model comes along, that's the one to move forward with. And I would also suggest that there actually is some fairly good evidence to talk about how very specific musical idioms and artistic expressions evoke or have physical properties that would lead them to have, you know, sonorous, you know, there's a reason that the, for instance, the octave in music is you know, found in almost every musical expression and culture, and it's because, you know, a C above, you know, one C is exactly twice the frequency of the C
right.
that's, you know, below it.
Right, or more to the point, there's a reason that Mack Wilberg pitches all the last verses up a whole step from the one before, right?
and every EFY song has a suspended fourth leading up to the bridge.
Yep.
Correct.
You guys are nerds. Love it. Michael, thank you so much. That is a fantastic section. Listeners, we are going to talk about the Holy Ghost here in a minute, but yet we still have a little bit more to do just on the whole nature of experience and what's going on with our brains, and now especially the sociological and other factors here. So if you can hang in with us, and Scott, if anytime any of you guys see a real connection to the hardcore, you know, dilemma that a lot of people are finding themselves in on how do I know when it's the spirit versus emotion, even if we're kind of talking more abstractly still for a little bit longer, let's try to make those connections a little more explicit. But Scott, can you take us into this material you prepared on different types of biases and different sorts of factors that also cloud this question?
Yeah, absolutely. So maybe just a little bit more of the bio here, which is I mentioned that kind of part two of my faith transition, faith journey this last summer, the big milestone, was a situation, and I don't want to go into too much detail because it involves people that I don't want to disclose. However, basically, a person in my life that was close to me made a decision, and you know, following the pattern of personal revelation as taught in the church, and we'll dig into that a little bit. But you know, it's what everyone knows. You know, come up, if you have a problem, think about it, come up with an idea, pray, and then wait for, you know, the answer to come to your heart and mind. Following that stat, he made a decision, which 4 months later he followed the same path and made a completely opposite decision to undo the first one, created a really difficult situation and fairly traumatic experience for a number of people. And basically that really caused me to think, okay, what's going on here in terms of, you know, spirit versus emotion? You know, I know that this person is a wonderful, you know, righteous person. And while there's always that, you know, possibility that they didn't do it right, or that there was something there that was blocking God from talking to them, how is it that someone who's doing it all correctly could misinterpret this, either on the first side or on the second or both? And so what I decided to do is I spent some time talking about or researching the theology of personal revelation in the church to see if I could get any nuggets there, and we'll get into that a little bit later. But what I did next was delve into Michael's world, unfortunately without a PhD, so there's a good chance that Michael's going to have to jump in and correct my faulty explanations here.
But well, I don't have one yet either, Scott, so we're on the same page.
closer than I'll ever be. And I sketched out kind of, you know, what I learned, so I'll just run through this a little bit. You know, we hear heart and mind, feeling and thought, and we tend to think of those things as being separate that aren't really quite connected. I mean, obviously, you know, if we stop and think about it for a while, everyone realizes that the heart delivers blood and oxygen to parts of the body and has no cognitive functions. There's nothing really emotive going on there. And yet we still have this dichotomy. But one of the first things that I was drawn to in studying psychology was that those things that we consider thoughts really have a lot of emotional content, and those things that we think of as feelings have a lot of cognitive content. In fact, there's an author, Burton, who said, "Feeling such a certainty, conviction, rightness, and faith arise out of involuntary mental sensory systems that are integral and inseparable components of the thoughts that they qualify." Or in other words, it's a package deal. If you're feeling something, that feeling is directed towards a thought. And if you're thinking about something, you're not ever going to be completely neutral on the thought. There's going to be some feeling that's attached, whether it's shame, guilt, or even a feeling of certainty. And this was one of the second things that really struck me, was this concept that despite how certainty feels, it really isn't precisely a conscious choice or even really a thought process. That certainty and other similar states of just knowing what we know, or what's known as meta-knowledge, really arise fairly involuntary on mechanisms that you know, very similar to love or anger or hate, really do function independently of reason. And that was, you know, something that was fairly tough to swallow initially, because if there's nothing that, you know, we as human beings reject, it is the idea that we are not, you know, completely in control, especially of what we're thinking about. but the most psychology that I was able to get my hands on did posit that conviction wasn't necessarily a choice. There was a book that described a patient who was describing his near-death experience who said, "It's no great accomplishment to hear a voice in your head. The accomplishment is to make sure that it is telling you the truth."
Huh.
And I thought that was kind of interesting to think that, you know, we're all subject to feelings in our minds and in our hearts telling us what to do. Most scientists believe that conscious thoughts are really the tip of the iceberg, and that the vast majority of thinking actually occurs outside of our awareness. So, you know, kind of like the computer that we program and we set in the background that's kind of whizzing away while we're doing everything else, crunching the numbers and doing the analysis, our subconscious is constantly working on the inputs that we've received, you know, days, weeks, months, even years earlier. And a major problem in distinguishing this conscious from the unconscious is that it's inherently difficult to assign the intentions to our thoughts occurring outside of our consciousness. In our tradition, in Mormonism and other religious traditions, we ascribe a very high value on thoughts that occur outside of our intended thoughts. And we tend to ascribe them to revelation in a number of circumstances. And I think that everyone can accept the idea that, you know, our motivation and our intention really do represent, you know, complex interactions between what we consciously and unconsciously want. Yet, however, when an idea appears without, you know, the immediate preceding effort, it doesn't feel intentional. There's a strong desire to attribute that to an external source.
Yes.
And so, you know, to use a computer analogy, you know, if I set a computer to do a very long computation and then I walk away and get a sandwich, and I come back and I'm working and a few hours later I hear a ding and I look and I see that the analysis is done and it's brought together an answer, I'm not going to be, you know, surprised that came up. However, the computer that's in the background of our subconscious is constantly whizzing and whirring. Since we didn't necessarily set it in motion in the first place, when those thoughts pop up, we tend to say things like, "Gee, what's this? Where did this come from?" And can attribute it to forces outside of our own. And I guess, you know, I should interject here that, and Michael made this point earlier, that just because we're stating that a brain process occurs does not mean that there's an exclusion of anything else. So when I am talking about the subconscious bringing thought without an immediate preceding effort, and that's being completely inside of ourselves, that does not necessarily mean that it has been disproven that any effort that pops into our mind is not of God, just that many of them that do will be completely within our own minds.
Yeah, and then what you also need to at least suggest, at least I know this is William James's argument about the subconscious, is that it might be bumping up against what he calls the more, or, you know, just the things that are not the mind itself, and it maybe it's, you know, because it's on that marginal level between who we are and our minds and this larger thing, you know, you sort of get this sense of, for him, that you sometimes have the eruptions of the more, you know, through this subconscious mind. So in other words, to say it's, even if it is your subconscious mind, isn't to say that necessarily that your subconscious mind isn't touching
something else.
Yeah, or it isn't embedded in, you know, this primordial energies or whatever it
is that's
driving the universe. So yeah.
It's subconscious, so by definition we aren't going to be able to peel it back and see. However, one thing that I thought was really interesting is that if you think of the iceberg analogy, the water line between, you know, what's above the thinking of thinking and our conscious thought process and what's below in the subconscious, really that water line moves and that iceberg
yes.
will bob up and down. And that's based on things as innocuous as, you know, the level of stress, our diet, our exercise. The amount of cognitive activities being generated is going to move that water line up and down. And what, you know, and you can get into things like fasting, you know, when you are literally starving your brain of energy when your body tells itself, "Hey, I'm not getting food. Let's not send glucosamine up there. Michael, feel free to jump in if I'm getting something wrong here, because I'm really up against the limit of understanding on this. But it seems that, you know, something like fasting actually can move the waterline such that the subconscious has a higher role and can bubble up those thoughts that without the immediate preceding effort, such that we really are experiencing more moments of revelation on a very biologic level when we're going through something like that.
Yeah, but again, it doesn't rule out a metaphysical component that there's something that the subconscious is.
That's right. Nothing here can, and I would suggest that nothing else, nothing necessarily would. I think that the biases that we're going to talk about here are important for awareness, because there are, and you know, and this is an area where biologists and theologians agree. There does exist the possibility of making the error in judgment between the two. You know, there are some scientists who would say every attribution to the divine is an error, but most theologians, or including, you know, leaders within our own faith, will say there does exist the possibility. So from my perspective, this is an important understanding. If we need to understand spirit versus emotion, we need to approach it from both the spirit and emotion angles.
Also, if I could interject really quickly here, one of the other errors that I think is commonly made that's very troubling to me is to say, okay, because we're able to assess biological underpinnings for these experiences, therefore they're illusory, they're meaningless, and we can just dismiss them.
That's right.
Independent of the metaphysical or divine questions of their origins, yeah.
And then there's one more element. Just because you access something that we'll quote unquote call deeper, it doesn't mean that it's true. You know, there's just a different energy, there's just a different feel to it, but it doesn't mean necessarily that it's wiser. I tend to sometimes, you know, make the error of always thinking that, oh, when I'm, you know, when it really does come from this non-rational, you know, process is the way I normally work out things in my life, that it is always true, always right. I don't know. I think all you can really basically say is I'm having an energy state difference here.
That's exactly right. And I would say that religion is not the only one that religion is not the only field of human understanding that's subject to that. There's actually a number of pop psychology books, including Emotional Intelligence and Blink. And I know I'm going to upset some listeners who absolutely love those, but that do have this idea that you can train your subconscious to only bubble up good stuff. And the fact of the matter is that our subconscious is going to bubble up stuff that seems illuminating and has a great feeling of knowing and tends to point to something where rationally we think it should go, but that we cannot necessarily peel back that layer of subconscious and understand where that really came from. And because of that, a strict reliance on that moment of insight without any other tools, I think, is potentially dangerous.
Good stuff.
So, you know, one of the things that Michael talked about is this kind of social milieu that we exist in and how our brains, you know, develop within that society. And one thing that I came across is this concept that thoughts require sensory information. In other words, we cannot think about something if there hasn't been something taken in from our sensory perception to help formulate that thought, which is why, you know, if we are Mormon living in Provo, or in Washington or wherever, and we have not been exposed to other faith traditions, the odds that we are going to receive a personal revelation, to pick up the sacred Hindu text Bhagavad Gita without having heard of it, to look for an answer is probably fairly limited.
Mm-hmm.
And for the same reason that an Indian living in Delhi is not going to necessarily wake up and feel prompted to read the Book of Mormon, not suggesting that that hasn't or would not ever happen, just that we tend to have those thoughts bubble up in our mind where the sensory information has already occurred. So we should think about that in terms of the importance of taking in additional sensory information through experiences with other people. I think you see this a lot in Joseph Smith, where as he's forming his theology, you know, he is coming into things And immediately you're seeing elements of those things becoming incorporated into Mormonism. Another thing that I think is worth mentioning here, and this again gets to how our brains function, and Dan, you mentioned this earlier, is that our brains are actually anatomically biased to preferentially hear and see what we're exposed to as young children. What we are told is correct when we're children will shape all of our subsequent language-based thought. So in other words, when we say that the Spirit is speaking to us in our language, it does not just mean the Queen's English, but the Mormon Idaho English that our parents spoke, which may be different even than the, you know, Mormon English in Arizona that someone else's parents spoke.
Good, good. Now, is that considered the primacy effect?
Yes, it's similar and related to the primacy. So the primacy effect is actually a bias. This is actually more brain development. But
Okay. I didn't know if you were kind of moving into it and just not using the labels.
So basically the bias. So we've talked about kind of how our brains build the foundation, and the biases are really the scaffolding that we build on top of it. So the primacy bias is basically you are more likely to hold on to and keep an idea if you heard it first rather than if you heard it later. So an experimental study which has shown this is if you give two people a list of personality traits of a hypothetical individual, and with group A the first five are positive traits and the second five are negative traits, and then you switch those with the second group, the group who heard the positive traits first, when asked to summarize this individual, will summarize an individual who is a good person with a couple of flaws. Then if you move over to group two and ask them to describe the individual who has the exact same characteristics in a list, just in a different order, they will say, actually, this isn't that great of a guy, but he has a couple of redeeming qualities. So if we hear something earlier, that is much more likely to become part of our worldview than something that we heard later as we're subject to that bias.
Right. Good. Good. Keep going.
Yeah. So another bias that is related to this is confirmation bias. And this is a bias that's brought up fairly regularly in religious conversation, which is and it is related to how to our brain development as well, which is, once we have a view of how the world works, we literally, you think about our senses, and they are bringing things in left and right. I don't know if anyone knows offhand the number of sensory experiences we have on a daily basis, but you can just look around you wherever you're standing now and think about how much information you could take in if you wanted to. You know, if you're looking at a tree, the number of small branches that are attached to a larger branch. You could literally sit where you are and be completely consumed for a long time trying to understand that. So the bias that our brain has developed is this confirmation bias, whereby it only takes in that information which is supporting of the view that it already has. And if you haven't done the white shirt, black shirt basketball game, I don't want to give it away to any of the listeners who haven't had the chance to do it, but Google it and see, or have a friend do it and see if they can set it up for you. But it's a very powerful example of how if we have our focus on seeing a specific thing, not only will we see that thing every time, but we will not see anything else, even if it's large and staring us in the face.
Good. And we hear confirmation bias a lot, it seems, on the Mormon stories of, the different podcast communities. It seems to be the thing that a lot of people are always saying is you only remember the hits, you ignore the misses. So when you have, oh, I knew my friend was going to call, well, how many times do you think of your friend was going to call that they didn't, and yet you favor the one time that they do, and then you're saying somehow there must be this vibrational connection, or the spirit told me, that this was about to happen.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's another piece of confirmation bias that I'm always hearing.
And because these groups tend to self-select and they tend to, the online groups, you will see confirmation bias towards really any end. And certainly the burden of proof, even towards a negative comment within certain groups, is going to the bar is going to be very low. So you can make a critical comment on the church. I won't pick on any specific Facebook page, so I don't get hate mail. But I think everyone who's on there, you know, who's on these pages knows of a page or two where you can make an unsubstantiated negative critical comment, and substantiation or evidence is not necessarily required. The claim itself is sufficient evidence. So I'll just run through a few of these other cognitive biases, and then, you know, maybe we can move on and talk about, you know, the church perspective and then what we do about it. But loss aversion, people play not to lose. So I attended Harvard Business School, and there's a professor at Harvard Business School who would do a very interesting experiment. Basically, what he would do is he would put a $20 bill on the table and say, I want everyone to start bidding for this $20 bill. Whoever has the highest bid gets the $20 bill, but there's one catch. Whoever has the second highest bid has to pay me the money, but they don't get any money in return. And so, you know, the students think, oh, this is pretty easy way to make, you know, a few bucks. And so they start bidding, and it starts at $1 and $2 and quickly gets up to the range of $12 to $15. And by that time, you generally have just two or three people left. Something really happens, or really interesting happens around $19, though, where the bid who's directly before has a decision to make. They can either bid at $20 and essentially break even, or they cannot bid and be assured that they're going to lose $18. And what ends up happening is, as you can imagine, the person goes to $20, the person who's at $18 goes to $20, everyone in the classroom laughs, and then they sit back as they watch a very serious game of brinkmanship where two people continue to bid up well beyond $20, sometimes getting as high as a couple hundred bucks. And so what happens is we quickly get to a point where our loss aversion kicks in, or we are playing not to lose. And it's, you know, it's just brought up at Harvard Business School because this happens constantly in the markets where people play not to lose, and their loss aversion leads them to not sell when they should sell and take a smaller loss. And even though there's a possibility of a very low possibility of a return, that they will hang on to that low possibility. And so the loss aversion slips into commitment bias, which is when someone says to withdraw now is to accept a sure loss. And so my commitment says that I will take the option of hanging on, even though the chances of success are small and the cost of delaying failure is very high. So, you know, I don't necessarily feel the need at this point to draw a strict religious alliteration here, but I think we can all think of situations in our lives, whether they're religious or not, where we've had a certain belief that letting go of it was something that was painful, that we wait until the last minute. Maybe it's a relationship or something else. But that's a force that is certainly in play. Value attribution is a really big one. That is that we look to others to ascribe value. I think, you know, Christine and Michael, it sounds like we're eating at the music analogy. So I'll give a quick musical anecdote. A few years ago, in a Washington, D.C. subway, a violinist went up to the turnstile and dressed kind of raggedy, pulled out his violin and began fiddling. The violinist was Joshua Bell, one of the greatest violinists in the world. The violin he pulled out was a $3 million Stradivarius, and the piece that he started playing was a Bach sonata for unaccompanied violin, which is one of the hardest, most difficult pieces in all of the violin repertoire. Over the next several hours, 1,097 people walked by Joshua Bell in the subway as he was giving this concert. A couple stopped for a few minutes to listen, but only one person who happened to listen to him and recognize him came and then listened and stayed for the duration. And the rest of them walked by the world's greatest violinist playing one of the world's most expensive violins and the most amazing pieces, because there wasn't anyone else around them to justify ascribing value to that situation or to that place. And so we can think about, within our religious experience and otherwise, how many messages ascribing high value to us do we hear to a certain belief system, and how many experiences we have ascribing significant negative value to other religious or other worldviews. That does not necessarily prove that one worldview or the other is wrong or right, but it does say that there is going to be a very strong tendency in any situation to ascribe higher value to that system or to that belief for which our peers around us are ascribing high value.
Wonderful.
Conformity. I think that this one is an important one as well and is related to value attribution. The famous experiment here is Solomon Asch had a group of people in a room. All of them were Confederates except for one, and he asked them to identify which line was longer than the other lines without in a situation where everyone, where there was no conformity, only one out of 35 people did not change their answer to something that's clearly wrong. However, when the Confederates were pointing out a line as being longer, even though it was clearly obvious that it was shorter, 75% of people gave a wrong answer if they were the only person in the room who was not a Confederate and purposely giving the wrong answer.
Wow.
So there is a very strong inclination among humans of all stripes to not be that lone voice, to not be the one who's giving the wrong answer. Probability.
yeah.
What was that? I'm sorry.
No, that's just fantastic. This is all really relevant. I'm just wondering, are we ever going to be able to get through all this? I mean, all this is going on in our not through your list, but you're just setting up a huge task for the rest of the podcast. Yeah,
it is a huge task. And there, you know, my quick glance at Wikipedia lists 54 different cognitive biases.
Oh man.
And you can go through the experiments, and I think that's the really powerful, is you can look at the experiments and see how powerful these different biases can be. The punchline is that the psychologists that I have read have said something along this line, and this is Robert Burton. He said, there's no isolated circuitry within the brain that can engage itself in thought free from involuntary and undetectable influences or biases. Without this ability, certainty is not a biologically justifiable state of mind. So, and we can talk about the difference between certainty and best guess. And you know, the position is not that because we cannot be certain, all decisions or all ideas are completely relevant in their likelihood. In fact, probability is you know, something that I've learned within management and other places as being a really powerful tool, and I think we can use it more in our lives. But certainly, it does create an interesting and important quandary to understand as we think about how justified our certainty in certain things can be.
Okay, now let me just complicate that a little bit. There's two levels of certainty. You can be certain that I am having a sensory experience. I can be certain that my mind, or you know, there's chemicals firing because of this experience that, you know, probably wouldn't be firing if I was having a different experience. So you can say something is going on. What you're saying is the certainty is in when we try to explain what it means or explain it's at that level of it, right? So we can be certain that things are going on. We just can't. You know, can't say that I have now explained it perfectly.
That's right. Although I would say that there, you know, like in any discipline, there are extremists, you know, who take it to a nihilistic end, which basically says that the, you know, free will is an illusion. It actually is fairly similar to physics, where you trace all of these threads to their logical end, and you're coming up with this idea that nothing can possibly be real. But yeah, so that does pose the question then, you know, what do we do now that we realize that this is all going on in every human everywhere to one degree or another? It does pose the question of how we can construct a workable framework for living and for, you know, not just for deciding what is it that is our emotion and what is coming from an external source, but even internally, how do we ferret out these things that we know are happening inside of us?
The Holy Ghost, man.
That's right.
That really is I mean, prior to, you know what, would through our adolescence, unless some of us were, you know, thinking Cartesian dualism, like Michael when he's in the primary getting the hand in the glove. Just, I know you weren't naming it that, but you were at least, you know, thinking of dualism then. But for most of us, and prior to the complications that we'll call a faith transition, or at least, I'm now in a different relationship with meaning and what the purpose of life is, and if there's a purpose of life. Prior to that, there was this sense that there was this infallible gift from God that would let you know when you are plugged into the truth, and that there was, therefore, if you are experiencing this, the cognitive framework that you happen to be in that situation is also confirmed. I mean, those are two different things in some ways. You can always say the agitation of me in this burning of the bosom way. Yeah, you know, you might claim that, you know, clearly biologically we could probably map that, that something is happening on there that would cause that feeling. But it's always that it's the mapping on of what it all means there. But
yeah, and Dan, I find it interesting that you use the term, or that you refer to the infallibility in the past tense, because I actually have a couple of quotes right here from apostles talking about the Spirit as an infallible guide from the past 10 years.
Good. No, that's the language. And I'm just saying it was probably the language that almost every listener of this podcast, probably everyone on this panel, we had that at some point before this was complicated, right?
Right.
And we used to, that was the assurance that we had, well, there is a way. You know, you align yourself in such a way that God will have this comforter. God will have this, you know, being who can shoot it right into, you know, can bypass everything that postmodernism is bringing. All these biases can be shot through by this thing called the Holy Ghost. And it's a real loss to start to say, man, I'm going to have to, what, use probability? I'm going to have to, you know, see how it all adds. I mean, we're right now at least in the nub of what I think we wanted to wrestle with.
Yeah, that's right. And maybe that is actually a bias. The last bias I'll bring up is that we do have a bias for simplicity. Now, this one, the last one I'll bring up, and we can move off it, but I think it's an interesting transition. There was an experiment done with medical doctors, and this should make everyone think twice before they go to the hospital again. Although it was actually residents, so hopefully they were able to learn from this experiment. But basically, they were given a group of fictitious diseases, one which was a fairly straightforward diagnosis of a single issue. A second was a combination of a couple of different diseases causing different parts of the system, and then the third was even more complex, involving genetic factors and environmental factors. It was a very complex diagnosis, and they asked the doctors or the residents to say which one of these is the more likely outcome. Well, there was no probability of any of these given. However, the vast majority of respondents said it's the more simple one. And when they were asked why, they said, well, because it's more likely that it's a simple answer than a complex answer. Again, there was no information to suggest that that was the case. That was simply the bias that they had and that we have, is that a bias towards simplicity. And if it's in the absence of additional probability information, if we have a simple answer and a complex answer, we're going to be drawn towards the simple one.
Yep. Good. Excellent. Okay. If I've made you leave some off, I'm sorry.
No, that's great. No,
you feel like you kind of
got. I've got through 8 of the 51. Okay. I'm all good.
Okay. Good. So you said Wikipedia. Just type in cognitive biases, and people can.
Yep. And it's Wikipedia, so you. I have a high degree of certainty. I absolutely know without any lack of certainty that the answers people have put up on Wikipedia are true. So,
good stuff.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well.